A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Ruler interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at ruler.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Ruler, and this is Ruler Conversations. I'm joined by Ruler's roving photojournalist, James Start. We're going to be talking about the latest edition of Ruler, which is out on Friday this week, and also Ruler Live, which happens next week. It is all go, James. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Finally, this long, long Indian summer here in Paris has finally given way to full-on autumn. I can almost feel winter coming. It's just grey and raining all day long, like it usually is at this time of year.
City of lights, love, and slightly overcast clouds this week. So, Ruler 123, the Futurology edition, is out this week. And we'll get to that, but first, drop everything and buy your tickets for Ruler Live, which takes place between Thursday, November the 2nd and Saturday, November the 4th at the Truman Brewery in Shoreditch. Ruler is the world's best cycling magazine, and Ruler Live is the world's best cycling event. It's bigger and better than ever this year. There are amazing guests, including Geraint Thomas, all three Paris-Roubaix Femme winners on stage at once, Vincenzo Nibali, Matej Mohoric, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, and many, many more. There are dozens of exhibitors showing the very latest bike tech, and also collections of vintage bikes, photography galleries, a bar, hundreds of other like-minded people, plus us, the editorial staff of Ruler. James, what have you most been looking forward to at Ruler Life?
Well, first, just the vibe, because it's just so much fun. And it's really a great celebration of cycling and everything we love. I guess on a personal level, this year, I've been asked to be more involved with the photo galleries. We're going to have a nice exhibit of all the winners of the Mark Gunther Award. I've been overseeing that, so I can't wait to see that actually get hung up on the walls. I'll also have a series of my portraits that I've taken over the year of cycling champions, so I really look forward to seeing that big and on the walls. But there's some other stuff I love. Obviously, the vintage stuff I love. My friends, the Belgian, do we call them? I guess they are true street artists, Puncher. They're the guys who do the silhouettes of the cyclists' faces on the roads of the cobblestones. I mean, if that's not street art, what is it, right?
Literally art on the streets.
Exactly.
It?
They'll be back, so I can't wait. They're really nice guys. I think they do really original work, so I'll be really excited to see them. Going to listen to some of the talks. Geraint is just such a giant on the sport now. You know, still in there. Just signed a new 2-year deal with Ineos, I guess. I mean, he just got second in the Giro d'Italia this year. I mean, one of his best results ever. He's shown no signs of backing down. So I think that's going to be a fascinating talk. I'm also looking forward to finally catching up with Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. I've been trying to track her down for about the last year for the magazine. But we'll finally get to see her at Ruler Live, and I got a little time with her too. So there's a lot of stuff.
For both of us, Ruler Live last year was our first. This time we kind of know the lay of the land a bit better. And what I'm looking forward to is, you know, the same again, all the same amazing exhibits and amazing talks, and like you, the vibe. But also we've got a bunch of new stuff happening this year. We've got so much good stuff going on the stage. We can't include everything we want to. So we've got a second stage, the other stage, with various talks, book signings. You're doing a presentation about photography on there. So that's an addition this year. Looking forward to the expanded bar area. What's better than a bar? A bigger bar. And also the Ruler Creative Hub. We're going to have the Ruler office out on the floor of the exhibition this year, so people can come and have a chat, come and have a chinwag, give us feedback, buy us drinks, buy us cake, and we're there to just help and answer any questions about what we do. And we felt, rather than being hidden away in a back office, it'd be better to be out in the show right in the middle of it. So I'm looking forward to all of those things and more. There's a special deal for loyal listeners to Rulo Conversations. If you go and buy a ticket on rulo.cc, enter the code RLPODCAST, you will get 10% off the entry price. But move fast, because we're running out of tickets and we hope to see you there. So, James, the latest edition of Rulo, number 123, the Futurology edition. It's landing with subscribers on Friday this week, recording on Monday. This podcast should be out by Wednesday. We think a lot about the future in cycling, don't we? We're always on to the next thing. It's a sport that never stands still, either in terms of the evolution of the races or from the technology standpoint. And there's a load of bikes featured in this magazine, which was modern as they come. The first thing I want to say is that the cover of the Futurology edition of Rulo, designed by our art editor Henry Cadell and featuring illustrated tarot cards made by Rodrigo Serna, is an absolute work of art, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, Enrique, he's so creative, and he has, you can tell he just embraces every new cover design and comes up with these ideas. And we kind of work through it, playing with different colors and the background and stuff, and it just looks better and better, and he nailed it. Yeah, it's subtle and smart, and it's Rulo.
The tarot cards were taken from a set designed for one of the features within The Future of Bike Transfers by the artist Rodrigo Serna. And they're so cool. We're probably going to have a bunch of those printed up, aren't we? And we can start doing our own tarot readings with those. But first big feature in the magazine, James, is yours. It's an interview with Greg Van Avermaet, the recently retired Belgian cyclist. The future as a professional cyclist has run out for him, but now he's contemplating the rest of his life as an ex-cyclist. So you went to have one last interview with Greg Van Avermaet at the Canada races this year. How was he, and what were your takeaways?
Well, Greg is always great. I mean, I think I've said this before in the press, when we call him Golden Greg, and he got that nickname. I said, did you know we call you Golden Greg? And he said, no, I didn't. And he thought it was the Olympics. I said, no, Greg, we gave you that name well before the Olympics, because you've always been golden with us in the press. You're always available. You always give good answers. You're a straight shooter. What is there not to love about Greg Van Avermaet? And it reflects the way he races bikes. I mean, he's just a no-nonsense bike rider, looking for opportunities, maximizing everything he can. He was always one of my favorite riders. And it was great to sit down and catch up with him here, because he's always been just a class act and a class rider. And no, he's not wasting any time. I saw today he's already done his first triathlon. Crazy, huh? I don't know where he found the time to be running or swimming while he was still racing, but he's a tremendous athlete. He had a real future in soccer or football, if you would like. But he's like Sagan in that. They're just like, they're natural born athletes first. And they ended up choosing the bike. And they can do so many things. So anyway, he's a great guy. He's a real family guy. He just said, I've been selfish enough, taking enough time away from my family. It's time to be with them. And he wants to take some time off to travel. He said, you're not going to be seeing me in any sports director's cars anytime soon. But you might be seeing him in different parts of the world, because he wants to travel and be with his family.
It's funny, actually, because you described him as a natural-born athlete. My impression of him was that I'm not sure he was a natural. I mean, he's obviously very physically talented, but I think his achievements were built on hard work, stoicism, and just being willing to keep on banging away rather than special physical talent. When I look at riders like Mathieu van der Poel, his genetics are good. He's just a natural athlete. Obviously, he works very hard as well, but I get the sense of a natural athlete from him. Same with riders like Tadej Pogacar, who's immensely physically gifted. With Van Avermaet, it was equal parts, I think, physical talent, hard work, and a bit of je ne sais quoi as well.
Absolutely. No, when I said he's just a tremendous athlete first, it's because he started out in soccer and was already at a very high level. I mean, he could have gone pro in soccer. He was right there on that. And then he switched to cycling, and he was even better. So a natural born athlete in that he's just athletic. He's very good at a lot of athletic endeavors.
He does have good genealogy for to be a professional cyclist, doesn't he?
He's absolutely, you know, genetically gifted, if you will. I mean, his grandfather raced with Fausto Coppi. How good is that, right? His father was in the Olympics. Yeah, I mean, cycling was in his blood. It was like, you know, how did you avoid being a cyclist? You know, and he really wanted to play soccer or football, if you will. And his family embraced that. But he said the day he decided to become a cyclist, he said his family was very, very happy. That said, he obviously has tremendous natural ability. All the guys that are at that level do. Did he maybe had a little less than somebody like Sagan or some of these guys to make that last stretch to win those monuments, to win the Olympic Games? That was a lot of hard, hard work. Every teammate I ever talked to said he's one of the hardest working guys in show business.
Yeah, no, I agree. I always had a big soft spot for Greg Van Avermaet. I tend not to have so many favourites, but I liked him purely because I had that impression that there was more than physical talent that made him such a good cyclist. And he was also a kind of a bit of a precursor to the Wout van Aert, Mathieu van der Poel kind of all-rounders that we're seeing in the sport these days. He obviously wasn't on the same level even as Peter Sagan in that way. But I do remember when he was a very young rider, he won the points jersey at the Vuelta and was a very good sprinter. Also was good at classics, emerged to be, for one season, he was the best classics rider in the world. You know, he won everything except for the Tour of Flanders one. He won E3, Gent-Wevelgem, Paris-Roubaix, just missed out on the Tour of Flanders. And his Olympic Games victory was something he shouldn't have been able to do. He wasn't physically made for that course, but he got around that by smart riding, patience, and diligence. And that's why I always had a soft spot for him, because I think he achieved, in spite of a few limitations, rather than finding it all very easy.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy. Like, Sagan had that capacity to make it look easy. I'm not saying it always was for Peter, but he had the capacity to make it look easy because he had just that incredible explosive power and he was such an acrobat on the bike. But Greg didn't quite have that. Looking back, you know, he said, obviously, Sagan was my greatest rival, in a sense, because they were together a lot in the finals and they never played games each other. They just got in that final. No pulling your punches. I went to all these races in Quebec and Montreal, and they were always in the finals there. They never pulled any punches. They were very different people. I don't know they'd have a whole lot to sit down and chat about at dinner or anything, but on the bikes, they had immense respect for each other. And Greg, you know, he's very modest, and he said, my best days, I could push somebody as great as Peter Sagan to the limits, and on occasion even beat him. And on several occasions, the harder and longer the race was, the better Greg's chances got. I think he underestimated his own talent there, but he's just, you know, a modest guy by nature.
Yeah, I've found him to be a very honest racer. And I mean that in terms of he didn't play games. He didn't hold back. He liked bike races to be a competition to find who the strongest was on that day. So he was very straightforward. And he never moved down to Monaco or to a tax haven or to somewhere warmer. He stayed living in, I think it's Dendermonde, in middle of nowhere in Belgium, just stayed living there his whole life. I remember going around to his house to interview him once, and he was just happy to have us around, take photographs, sit in the garden, have a chat. He was in his element there. He was at home being himself, and I always appreciated that with him. He was very good with journalists.
Yeah, it was golden, huh? That's why we call him golden. But yeah, as a bike rider, he was one of those guys, he just took the racing to the others. He said, we're going to go for a bike race now. We're racing. Game on. Let's go. I talked to Jim Okowitz, who was longtime his general manager at BMC, and he said I was one of his favorite riders, and he's had a lot of great ones because he was so easy to work with on the team and always gave his all, and you knew he was going to be in the mix till the end. And Jim said, yeah, I mean, he's very honest, sometimes too honest. Sometimes he worked too hard, gave too much and came up, but he just didn't know how to do it any other way. So he's a real bike racer, I'd say.
And he's also good at the Tour de France in a way that not many riders are. For climbers and GC riders, the Tour is pretty straightforward. They rise to the top through physical talent and being strong on that terrain. Van Avermaet, he had two great stints in the yellow jersey. He won several stages over the course of his career. He was not quite on the same level as Fabian Cancellara, but Cancellara was another one of those riders who was good at the Tour de France. Like, Van Avermaet would show up, do his stuff, and end up in the yellow jersey. And on one occasion, wore the yellow jersey and then went into a break on a mountain stage just to show the jersey. Actually ended up gaining more time and keeping the jersey an extra few days. And he was he shouldn't have been that good at the Tour de France. It wasn't a race that was at all suited to him. I think maybe the modern Tour, the last couple of years, would have been a bit more suited to him, but he was past his best by the time the terrain shifted. But he somehow found a way.
Absolutely. His way was different than Cancellara's, I would say, though. I mean, they're similar in that they were both classics riders who also managed to get the yellow jersey for, what, 10, 15 days during their career, right? But Cancellara had the time trial to rock back on. And when he got it, he usually got it by nailing the prologue or the first time trial or the TTT with the team. And then he would carry it. Whereas the two times that Van Avermaet got it, he had to go out and get it. He had to go out and find it. He had to make those breaks. And he had to be the best placed rider in those breaks to get that yellow jersey. But that's quintessential bike racing. I mean, it's looking for opportunity. It's seizing the moment. It's making circumstances happen for you, and you're getting into a situation going, what can I do here? What can I make out of this move? Can I get the yellow jersey? Or am I just going for the stage win? Maybe I have to settle for a polka dot jersey for a few days, whatever. But what can I do to maximize my chances here? And Greg was a master at that.
Lastly, you talk in the magazine also about a portrait you took of him quite a few years ago, probably when he was at his peak, when he was still racing with BMC. We've put the picture over a double page spread in the magazine, but just talk us through the process of getting that brilliant photograph.
I've been the photographer at the Grand Prix of Quebec and Montreal since the beginning, and Greg has been to almost every one of them. A lot of times the Belgian press would ask me to get a picture of him for a feature, because this was always a race before the World Championships and stuff. So I'd gotten used to taking a picture of him here or there. And one day I said, hey, I got a great spot for us this year. And he kind of looked at me and said, okay, good. You know, whatever. And he came back from the ride. We were in the Chateau Frontenac, which is one of the most famous hotels in the world. It sits atop the hillside of Quebec overlooking the St. Lawrence River, and it's just spectacular. And this old historic hotel, this is where I believe Churchill and Roosevelt signed their accords to enter into World War II together. So, I mean, we're talking really a place with history. And there was this little room in the back I saw with like 19th century paintings and this chair that looked almost like a throne. And I said, Golden Greg in his throne. What better, right? As soon as he saw it, he said, okay, you know, he just struck this pose, relaxed. He had his sneakers on, his shoes in his hand. And it was this gorgeous picture in the depth of this old room. And I showed it to him. He said, oh man, that's really great. You know, I said, well, you know, I'll send you a copy if you want. Yeah, it'd be great. So I went up, raced up, because the Belgians wanted it for the Belgian edition. Sent it off, and I sent it to Phoebe Ames, who's the press officer at the time. And I said, here, Phoebe, this is for Greg. He said to send it to you, and you pass it on. He said, oh, great, thanks for that. Oh, by the way, you can't use it. He doesn't have the right sneakers on. They're not the team official sneakers. Now, one thing you didn't know is that Greg had actually really bad problems with his feet, down with his heels. I'm not sure exactly with the bone spurs or something, but had really struggled to find shoes that fit him. And I, you know, I wasn't thinking about that when I was taking the picture. I said, Phoebe, that's already gone. I mean, what are we going to do about this? He said, oh my gosh. And I said, that's such a great picture. I can't believe this. And then she said, what if he did it again? And I said, what if he did it again? What if he got dressed and put the right shoes on? I said, yeah, whatever. And 3 minutes later, I got the email back. Said, he's finishing lunch. He'll be down afterwards. Same kit. The right color sneakers. I'm not saying which ones they were. And, you know, looked at the picture, struck the same pose. We did it, click, baba boom. And it went back out to the world. And I actually made a print of that and gave it to him because I was very proud of that. And it's such a great story. And every time I see Phoebe or Greg, we always have a laugh about that one because it was a really stressful moment. And I was really proud of that picture. It was one of the best pictures I'd taken all year and one of my favorite portraits ever. It's going to be on display at Ruler Live. And not to be able to use it was just a heartbreaker. And this was 2018. Greg was winning everything. He was as big as it ever got for him. You know, how many guys at that level would say, okay, I'll get dressed again, come on back down and do the picture again? Greg did.
We'll have to have a special room out the back of Ruler Live for the sponsor Incorrect trainers. So that's Greg Van Avermaet. Another rider we interviewed in this edition of Ruler is a very different kind of rider, Taco van der Horn. So Richard Abraham, one of our contributors, fantastic writer who knows the sport inside out, pitched me Taco van der Horn quite a while back and said there's this guy who's got a poster of Graham O'Bree on his wall, and he's really innovative, and he's obsessed with kind of finding details and gains where other people don't find them. And I thought that would be an interesting addition to the futurology magazine because it kind of covers the more technological side of the sport. So that's Taco van der Hoorn. Richard wrote me the piece, and you went to Andorra to take some photographs of him. So before we talk about the piece and Taco, tell me about the experience of going up there to shoot Taco.
It was unforgettable. The other element about Taco was that he has his old VW camper bus, and he's committed to making this his altitude training camp, driving this thing up at 3,000 meters or whatever and hanging out for a few weeks up there. And I guess, you know, washing in a mountain creek or something, whatever. So I said, this is going to be, you know, an amazing prop, right, for the picture. So I called him. I said, yeah, you come on up. We're trying to figure out. I said, but there's a problem. My Volkswagen isn't going to make it up that climb. It's got to go in the shop and we got to get it fixed. I don't know what's going on. And I said, how are we going to do this? At the end of the day, we found a place that wasn't too far from him, just a mountain road, a gravel mountain road. And we took it up there. But even then, we were kind of calculating how long it would take for the poor thing to overheat. And he actually took it up, put it on, and rode his bike back down. And then I took him up. He got it, you know, so we got it up in different heats, I guess you would say. I just thought that the VW was so much like, it said so much about who he was that we had to put that in the piece. And it was, you know, obviously a pretty great piece. And then, you know, you walk in and he's got all these album covers, John Coltrane, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, he's a lover of music. Just got a lot of interests that were really interesting. It was a great story by Richard, a great find by Richard, because not that many people know about Taco really outside of his crazy name that everybody loves, crazy name for us, and just a lovely, lovely person. And he's also very courageous. He had a bad accident a few years ago. He was concussed for like, I don't know how many months. He came back and his first race back, he won. And in Flanders, he crashed again and he's suffered a concussion. He's been concussed again. And he's determined to come back and win again. And after talking with him, I don't see why he won't.
Now, it's funny, actually, because he is interesting to me in the same way that Greg Van Avermaet was, that he is finding a way to succeed in bike racing despite not having the supreme physical assets of the big champions. You know, with Greg Van Avermaet, the answer was work harder. With Taco van der Hoorn, it's work smarter. And he's an archetypally modern rider in a way. He's not a super strong guy who relies on numbers. He relies on ingenuity, aerodynamics, and research, whether that's research into his aerodynamics or research into training or research into his own physical capacities or research into the courses and looking at where in a race that he can make a difference, because he knows what he can do and what he's good at, and he needs to weaponize that in order to make a difference to other riders. And in spite of, again, not being the most physically gifted rider, he has carved out a pretty successful career. He's won 7 times. Yeah, he's not a huge race winner, but he has won a Giro stage. He's won several stages in the Benelux Tour, and he came within a tire's width of winning a Tour de France stage up against Simon Clark, another very clever rider, in that cobbled stage in the 2022 Tour de France. So Taco van der Hoorn has done very well. It's purely by looking at where he can make gains. I mean, he's experimented with different handlebars. He's looked at his position. He's just seems to be one step ahead of many of his peers out of necessity.
Absolutely. A really smart guy. I think you hit on something there. We all love the great champions and love watching Matthew Van Der Poel pound away on the world championship course or whatever. But most of us aren't made up that way. And these guys are the ones that give somebody like me always were so inspiring, because they're like, okay, you might not be a world beater, but if you're smart and you work hard and you always seize the opportunity that presents itself, you can get in that break. You can make something happen for yourself. And those are such sources of inspiration for me, not just on the bike, but in life.
And I sense he's found a home at Antelmarchi Wanty-Gobert that suits him. It's not exactly a left field team, but it's got a lot of characters on the team. It seems to be a team where individuals can thrive. There is no machine deciding how things are done. He was at Jumbo-Visma before, and he seemed, though he's a good rider, and I'm sure he did well on Jumbo-Visma, I sense he's happier at Antelmarchi, where his intellect can flourish and he's not part of a greater plan where there's a lot of people doing a lot of things all towards one goal. He's trying to cut his own path, and Antomir actually gives him the freedom to thrive in that sense. And I think that's probably the right team for him in a way that Jumbo Visma wasn't.
They're a very eclectic team, almost as eclectic as their jersey, right? It kind of goes in all kinds of directions. But I think it's a good home for a lot of guys. I was talking with Guillaume Martin, who was at Cofidis. We were talking about teams, and he said, you know, I had really good years at Wanty. Lilian Calmejean said, I feel like I finally found my home here. Biniam Gourmet, I did a story on him just last week for the web. And, you know, we did a big feature on him earlier in the year for the magazine. And then, he had a lot of misfortune this year. But the team was behind him the whole time and said, hey, you got a contract for several years. Don't you stress now. You know, we don't expect you to repeat all of the incredible things you did last year. You're still young. You're still growing. We're here with you to help you grow. And they were with him the whole time, and they still are. So I see a very smart, sensitive, and sensible team that gives a lot of guys that wouldn't have a chance elsewhere or wouldn't have the same chance an amazing opportunity.
So that's Taka van der Horn. Words by Richard Abraham, photographs by James Starr, and just looks like a really interesting guy. I love the photographs of him with his records. It just shows a hinterland that often professional cyclists either don't have or are reluctant to show. So really appreciated that. So from bike riders to bikes, there's a feature again by you, James, called the Time Trial Collector. You pitched this to me a while back. It's a collection of old bikes. And the thing about these bikes is that they were all once futuristic, but they're futuristic from a long time ago. So they've aged in a way that's kind of quite interesting. So tell me more about this collection of time trial bikes.
Well, I found this guy just on social media, and Sebastian, and he had these amazing bikes. I was like, I kind of remember when that came out, or I kind of remember this or that, or did I remember that? I don't know. And I chatted with him a bit and discovered he was passionate about all these time trial bikes from the late 80s up to the mid 90s until what was called, I believe, the Lugano Accord in 1996. And up until that point, it had been kind of open bar for bike design in terms of aerodynamics and all of this. And then they really clamped down and made a lot of restrictions. So what he had, what I saw in his collection, was this sort of timepiece when the future was wide open for bike designers. And they were being so creative and pushing all kinds of limits. I don't know if all of these bikes actually went that fast, but that was their goal. That was the attempt. And so they were, it's sort of a timepiece and a study of the future, if you'd like. And then even though they would certainly not break any world records today, outside of perhaps Chris Boardman's Lotus, I still think that looks like a pretty fast bike. They were aesthetically so intriguing that looking back on them 20, 30 years ago now, they were just like, who would have ever thought about that? I mean, there's this Tomasini fork that's got like its own front whole triangle on it. It was the most crazy thing. Several of the bikes were by this amazing bike designer Pacenti in Italy, who worked on the with Cinelli on the Epic Laser, which was a great time trial profile bike, basically a prototype for all of the big world hour records in the 80s. But he didn't stop there. He went to these just crazy designs one after the other. So I just thought it was an amazing timepiece for what was such a forward-looking moment in bicycle design.
It was the first time, really, through the late 80s and early 90s, where for the first time the traditional two-triangle shape of the bike with along the fork was being challenged. It's partly a function of the new materials that are being developed, like carbon fiber was at that time a modern material. You know, it had been used in the aerospace industry and then went through to engineering and cycling. And it's a function of the fact that you could now start to make frames in these different shapes that weren't built along preformed tubes. I love the fact that the Bianchi time trial bike there, it looks elegant. The lines are kind of liquid and smooth. The celeste colour is amazing. And yet it's got toe straps and clips. It's such a great combination of a modern frame and disc wheels, along with what the reality was at the time, which is that most people hadn't graduated onto clipless pedals yet. Obviously, Chris Boardman's Lotus bike is, it is one of the most beautiful bikes ever designed. And you photographed it from the working side rather than the smooth side. The side the bike is usually photographed from shows the one-sided front fork and rear stay, but you've photographed it from the side where there is no fork and there is no stay, so the wheels look unattached. I just find the lines of that bike and even the colour scheme, the shiny black colour scheme, it's just so futuristic looking. The other bikes, like the Longe Jalabert's Look time trial bike, just outrageous, really. It looks like the triathlon bikes look these days. There's so many extra aero parts on it that almost doesn't look like a bike. Then a bike that's just right stuck on the tipping point between pure tradition and modernity, which is Laurent Fignon's Rallye bike, which is fairly standard, but it's got this big aerofoil on the saddle, which just makes it look totally off the wall. So amazing collection of bikes, which, like you said, they're both achingly modern, but they also look retro. It's a really funny combination, isn't it?
Yeah, I just knew that when I saw this guy, I found him, I knew one day it was just a question of time before we found the right theme, the right, you know, that it was going to really sing. You know, the guy's just passion. And some of the stories of him chasing these bikes down and trying to get them and all were really wonderful. And he treats them with such respect and has a whole floor of his house is devoted to exhibiting them. And he was really happy to have us come to spread the word about his passion.
For this edition of the magazine, I interviewed Jay Vine, the UAE cyclist from Australia. And he's another archetypally modern rider, James. He's a kind of product of the post-pandemic era in cycling because he famously got his professional break, his World Tour contract, or his professional contract by winning the Zwift Academy. And obviously the perception of that is that he's a numbers cyclist, that he's, you know, he can put out numbers on a stationary bike and therefore got a professional contract, but actually pretty good cyclist as well, pretty experienced cyclist. He'd been a cyclist for quite some time, fell in love with the sport as a young man and quickly developed. He moved to the UAE team. From our interview, he was pretty down on his year, on his 2023. He developed a knee injury in the UAE Tour, missed the spring races, got back for the Giro, but had a kind of disappointing Giro and crashed out of the Vuelta. And he was looking back on his year thinking, well, it's not honestly been the best. At the same time, he won the Tour Down Under. He won the National Time Trial Championships. And after we went to press on the magazine, he won a stage in Turkey at the very, very end of the season. So he kind of sandwiched a disappointing stretch of time with very good results. And I think he seems to have found a good place on UAE. He's kind of at that level, same level that George Bennett was when he was hired by UAE, not the Grand Tour leader, but a rider who can envisage stage wins in mountain stages and Grand Tours, who can target the podium of a Grand Tour. He can, I think, with his time trialing gifts and climbing gifts, he can target any week-long stage race in the calendar. And he also has ambitions in races like Liège-Bastogne-Liège and in Lombardia. So what's your perception of him, having read the interview and having watched him develop as a professional?
First, he's obviously a big motor. He does have the numbers in terms of watts and what he can put out, which opens a lot of doors. I think he's probably being a little bit hard on himself. I mean, he had some misfortune this year, but he still came around with some victories all through the season, which is very telling. Obviously, he's on an amazing team, one of the two very best teams, but it's a crowded house. So it's going to be a question of how much time will he have to ride for himself? How much time does he have to learn and adapt? He's at a great place to learn and adapt, but he's also going to be required to work and work for guys like Tadej Pogacar. And so it'll sort of depend how he settles. I'd say the verdict's still out in terms of his own goals and ambitions.
That's very true. I mean, on the positive side, when he won his Vuelta stage, the one in the mist in 2022, he did so by attacking the GC group on the final climb and winning a la pedale. Really, he outpowered Remco Evenepoel, all the other GC riders in 2022 on a mountaintop finish. And I think physically he has the gifts. But I think the most interesting thing about Jay Varner, and what I like most about him, is he's a very open book. He's a very open interview. He's very honest. This has got him into trouble in the past. He is quite unfiltered, and he says what he's thinking, whether that fits with what other people might find palatable to hear, what the team might want him to say. And I find that refreshing and engaging. And I loved talking to him and interviewing, because you can just sit back and let the honesty wash over you. And he got himself into a little bit of stickiness during the Giro this year, because obviously he didn't have the form to race as he would have wanted to at the Giro. When you miss most of the spring with an injury, you can't gain that fitness back very easily. And UAE were there with Joao Almeida, so he was riding in support of Almeida, and he was looking at what he could do in the race as well. And he was feeling a bit sick, and I think the interview that he gave before one of the stages pulled out of him the sense that he wasn't there to ride around and try and get a place in the top 10. And he said he just wasn't interested, not interesting to him, just didn't want to. There's no gain in it for him. There's no extra pay for him. He doesn't get a bonus for that. There's literally no point in him riding around for space in the top 10, because what he has been contracted to at UAE is ride for riders like Almeida, or to ride himself for a podium position, or to ride for stage wins. So in the position he was in at the Giro, with him suffering from bronchitis, I think it was, he wasn't in a position to ride for the top 10. What's the point in even doing that? And he wasn't really in a position to ride for a stage win, because he had to spend a few days recovering, trying to get round as best he can. Still did some okay work at the race, but he was there just to help Joao Almeida as best he could. And that was how it came, because obviously he got criticised on social media for disrespecting those riders who would find a place in the top, an extraordinary achievement. And that's fine for them. But for him, he honestly, he felt and said that that's not what he was there for. And I think that's fair enough.
We like straight shooters. Like Greg was like, has always been like that for Narvermont. And no, it's refreshing, because every team now is very filtered with communications, or a lot of these riders are getting training, what to say when, you know, and it can start to sound redundant. Those sorts of quotes are a dime a dozen, you know. And so when you get somebody breaking the mold and really answering what sounds to be sincere and is refreshing. And, you know, as journalists, we have to celebrate that.
Yep. And he is appearing at Rouleau Live as well. So, yeah, you know, I'm hoping that his talk will be even more unfiltered than the interview he gave me. And he's driving up in his Bentley. He loves cars, Jay Varner, so he's going to be driving up in his Bentley. And can't wait to see him in the flesh. Also in the magazine, the art cycle piece this edition is about a work by Natalia Goncharova, a female Russian artist who was, I guess, a futurist, which is why she fitted perfectly in the Futurology edition. And her most famous work is called Cyclist. So tell us about that work, James.
I discovered Goncharova a long time ago because, you know, I got a master's in art history, and my advisor at the time was a real specialist of Russian art, and particularly modern Russian art. And so she was a big champion of Goncharova, and Goncharova was such a groundbreaking artist. I mean, she was very respected in her circles and was exhibited with all of the greats. Just a real pioneer. So it was great to get back and to touch bases with her and study her work again. I actually reconnected with Janet Kennedy, my old mentor, and she went back into her archives to think a little bit about Goncharova and come up with some insight that I thought was interesting. And what the bicycle meant in Russian culture at the time. This is just before the outbreak of the war and then the Russian Revolution. It's pretty fascinating. She was, I believe, technically a cubo-futurist.
So what's the difference between a cubo-futurist and a futurist?
Well, it was, I think, more about where these movements kind of came from. You know, pure futurism was really an Italian movement. And I believe the cubo-futurist was very much a combination of that, and it was very popular for a spell in Russia.
What was the ethos of futurist artists, just so our listeners can get up to speed?
Well, they broke out form, human form, and objects in the real world in a similar way to the cubes, but they had much more of an interest in, for one, movement, moving through time and into the future, speed, movement, these things. And so a lot of their paintings and artworks captured movement in a very unique way. And so something like the bicycle was the perfect vector for that. That's why this is considered one of the real masterpieces of that genre. And they just saw movement as something that was just constantly taking us into the future, was constantly regenerating, was constantly just modern. They really focused on that as opposed to, say, the Cubists in France, you know, with Braque and Picasso, who did lots of still lives. I'd say that was the biggest or one of the most evident differences between, say, Cubism and Futurism.
The problem was how to convey movement in a static painting. And Gontarova Cyclist, obviously, it is a static painting, but you can see that movement. And lastly, it wouldn't be a Futurology magazine without the latest in bike technology and bike design. You wrote about two very different bikes, the Lapierre Obvious and Sui Aquis. Can you tell us about those two bikes, what they're about and how they differ from each other?
Well, the Lapierre bike we've seen before, you know, but it was really the design that was so special, as they partnered up with this collective of artists using artificial intelligence in the visual arts. And they've designed a wonderful, beautiful, really great Alpine sports car. And they work with Nike and some others. And they got hired by Lapierre to do the official Tour de France bicycle last year. And I saw it at the tour. I was like, this is stunning. And so we decided we're going to do something focusing on that. And then this new bicycle brand is just coming out called Sui, S-W-I. And it's a combination of Swiss and Italian creativity, let's call it. Some of the Swiss technology and manufacturing and the Italian creativity, if you want. That's very generalized, but let's just break it down as that for the moment. An amazing one-piece monocoque carbon fiber frame that's been designed along with former professionals Paolo Bettini, no need for introduction there, world champion, Olympic champion, Luca Paolini, just another very experienced professional. And they've been really working closely with this company, this new startup, to come up with an amazing bike, not only in construction and conception, but in look. It's a gorgeous bike. And I learned a lot about, you know, carbon technology, the making of the different ovens that they're using to produce, and the special ovens that were needed to produce this monocoque one-piece carbon frame, and the hours of work that go into it, layering layer after layer of carbon fiber around on the tube or, you know, the fork or wherever. And it takes at least 2 days, 2.5 days at best to produce one of them. And that's not just one person, that's several people working together. I mean, it's very labor intense. But anybody who has one of these is going to be very proud to be riding it.
Great looking bikes. And Sui are going to be at Rouleau Live. Also in the magazine, Rachel Jarry wrote us a piece about the Miami Blazers, Criterion team in the States. They're from focusing on an interview with Dante Young, and this very Florida, very American article. You're American, James. I know you're an adopted Parisian, but explain to me the fascination briefly with Criterium racing in the States.
How did that happen? I'm not sure. Did it come out of our, you know, track racing was very big in the States in between the wars and things like that. Did it come out of that? Did it come out of just convenience, because Americans couldn't understand shutting down their roads for so long and for such long stretches? I always thought it was kind of like that. It was much easier to, I think, for a small-time sport that bicycle racing was for so long in America, to get more than, say, a one-mile circuit closed off in a downtown. And it's, you know, it created its own breed of racing, and it's a special breed of racing. I mean, it's hard racing. I never suffered as much in bike races as I did sometimes in crits, because it's all about power, and you're whipping around some of those turns, and one error in placement, you can be gapped, and you only got so many cartridges you can use in that kind of, it's like the track. I mean, you only have so many shots to keep your position. It's a very unique sport in America, and the Criterion, the closed circuit, really gives way to the spectator sport aspect of it. It can be very dramatic and stuff. So yeah, it was a tremendous piece. It took me back to when I was racing crits.
Just came across as really, really colourful, really exciting. So that's the Miami Blazers cycling team. We've also got a feature about riding the Tracker gravel race down near Girona. We've got a piece about the Canyon Grail, which has been ridden by Alec Briggs of Tekkers. I've got an interview with Angelo Gotti, who is the owner of Cask and Coup. I've got a piece about Project Speed, which is a collaboration between BMC and the Red Bull F1 team, and many, many more features. So that's Ruler 123, the Futurology edition. Ruler Conversations listeners can get 15% off the regular price of a Ruler subscription by going to ruler.cc/subscribe and entering the code podcast15. By subscribing, you are supporting our journalism and enabling us to put out more excellent magazines. Physical magazines are things of beauty and tactility. So please subscribe to enjoy the unique reading experience of a physical magazine. But you can also subscribe to our app, which offers an electronic version of the magazine, plus all our web stories from Ruler.cc, plus the Ruler Conversations podcasts and an archive of the mag. And of course, don't forget, buy your Ruler Live tickets with the code RLPODCAST to get 10% off, and come visit me, James, and the rest of the editorial staff in our creative hub or office space out on the shop floor of Ruler Live. James, I'll see you in London.
You will. Can't wait.
You have been listening to Ruler Conversations. Ruler Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Ruler Magazine. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Ruler and on Instagram at Ruler Magazine, or visit our website at ruler.cc. This edition of Ruler Conversations was produced by Joseph Perry of Content is Queen.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.